name is Clancy Emmerslin, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here this morning, glad to be up in the mountains in the camp. Friday night I was talking down at something called the Mad Dog Days in India, which was 115 degrees. And I couldn't wait to get up here, it was only 100. I think I took a little chill. This country, because that reminds me of where I grew up in northern Wisconsin, except for the mountains in the distance, but that's the way it was with lakes and trees, and very nice to be here. Good place to be on a Sunday morning. I talked to some people I've known here for some years, and I was thinking, we're talking about age, you know, two or three years ago I turned 70, and I feel great. I feel like I'm 30 years old, but I when you turn 70, you realize that you're on the home stretch. No matter, there's no way out of that. I may, before this meeting's over, you may have to have that helicopter take me down. I don't know. When I was about 70, my doctor started giving me iron tablets, which I guess are supposed to help your blood or something. I don't know. And that's fine. Didn't seem to make any difference. But a couple months ago, in some experiment, I don't know why, I was reading too much advertising or something, I tried a Viagra. And I didn't realize that if you're taking iron tablets, you're not supposed to take Viagra. And now, every 4 hours, I face north. Like an old guy in our group says, he told me, he said, I'm now just taking an eighth of a Viagra every morning. I said, what the hell are you taking an eighth of Viagra for? Just so I won't pee on my shoes. But anyway. I am glad to be here. It's glad to see some old friends and some new friends. And glad to see Nancy and Kathy and a lot of other people that I've known. We were talking last night. I was talking to someone. Someone came up to me and said that was quite a program they did on A&E. I suppose some of you saw that program on A&E and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought about that. You know, they called me from New York a few months ago and said, incidentally, that A&E program, most of you know this, I'm sure, but they did a program on Alcoholics Anonymous, an investigative report. And then, as they always do in these things, they always have the other side. They interview someone from the other side. And so this woman on there, they were interviewing her about, she said, yes, A, it was a nice place, but she had come to understand that alcoholics could drink again if they drank moderately and would watch their drinking. And in fact, she's written a book, called Moderation Management. And it's, you know, she said A's all right, but for alcoholics such as she, moderation is the better answer. And now, again, some of you know, about a month ago, she was arrested for vehicular manslaughter, drunk driving, driving the wrong way in the freeway in Seattle, killed a little guy and his son, and is going to prison. And now her latest report is that she's decided that she's going to try AA. But, I mean, it's an interesting thing. We don't care if she does or not. To hell with her. I don't mean it that. I'm glad she's going to try A, but I'm sure there's a lot of people out there who believe what she said and are trying to drink moderately and may kill them. They asked me to be interviewed on this program. Of course, it's anonymous. And so they asked World Service House when I answered some questions. And in West L.A., there's a place called Ohio Street. It's got a lot of windows along the side like that, but no porch, so the sun beats down. So they put me in a chair in front of there with the sun behind me, and so you just see a black outline. And I believe very much in anonymity. Because of my work, I am on television a lot in Los Angeles and on newspapers. And a lady who showed me this morning an article in the Reader's Digest about me. But all, all of these things. I never mention AA because that's, you don't mention AA, it's anonymous. But I must say, when that camera was on me and I knew it'd be going all over the Western world, I just had a terrible temptation to kind of go. I fought it off. But the guy asked me some questions that didn't really get on the air, I guess because my answers weren't good enough. But he asked me, he started off, you know, usually those kind of interviews ask you questions like, well, how many members are there in your fellowship and where do you meet and so on. These are puffball questions. But he asked me some really tough questions to start with. First question he asked me, he said, can you tell me why is it that some alcoholics can stop drinking on their own and others need Alcoholics Anonymous? And that's absolutely a true statement. Our speaker last night talked about stopping drinking for 6 years without Alcoholics Anonymous before he came here. And there are some people who stop forever. And yet others seem to need Alcoholics Anonymous. Why is that? And that is an interesting thing when you stop and think about it, because everybody knows much about this, knows that it's a small percentage of people, but alcoholics who are able to stop. It seems as though they're indistinguishable from other alcoholics, but when their security is threatened, when something happens, when there may be a loss of a job or a loss of a family member, a death in the family, something significant happens. They suddenly are overtaken by the nature of what's happened, and they say, I quit! And they quit, and that's the end of it. Then there's also another type of alcoholic. Incidentally, you know, when Bill Wilson wrote this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, he knew there were these other types of things, but he couldn't put his finger on them and didn't know what they were. And so did not define them. So that's why in our book, again and again, he talks about alcoholics of our type. He doesn't say what the other types were, but these are the... But there's another type who not only become addicted, but they become physically addicted, and these are the people, they have to be medically withdrawn. They're the people for whom treatment centers were originally built, to physically take them off and show them the nature of their problems. So by the time they really get sober, they say, oh man, I ruined my life. I quit. And they quit. And then there's another type of alcoholic, which is by far the most numerous. Alcoholics, I suppose they call them of our type, who have a drinking problem, severe drinking problem apparently, and if something happens to threaten their security, maybe someone dies or a loss of a family member or loss of a job, and they realize the gravity and they say, I quit. But sooner or later, always begin to drink again. Then they also are the people who are physically withdrawn, realize the nature of their problems, and realize that it's just, something's got to be done, and I quit. And sooner or later, they begin to drink again. And these are the people that have often always baffled medical people and religious people and philosophers and especially family members. Most of us, I'm sure, have quit for good reasons. I think one of the saddest things I know about my life, one of the things that I remember, the sadness, is seeing in your family, or seeing in some place, I'm sure everybody's got their own thing, but promising at this time for a quit, and then eventually drink again, and then see that look on the face. That look that says, how could you? How could you? The children were just starting to straighten out a little bit. You're getting out back on your feet again. We're starting to feel good around, and here you are drunk again. How could you do that? And if you're like me, you have no answer to that question. I don't know how I could do that. I hate myself for doing it. And so you feel terribly guilty, so the only answer you can think of is things like, get away from me! Leave me alone, goddammit! Get away from me! And it hurts them even worse, but I don't know what else to say. You just don't know what to say. Those are alcoholics of our type. Those are the people who seem to need AA to have to stop. But this was kind of a long, complex answer. I didn't want to tell a guy that, particularly use involved in this film. So I just said there just seems to be some people who are alcoholic who seem to be able to stop, a small percentage of them, and most of them don't. But the sad thing is, the ones that need AA mostly think they're of the other type and will try to stop on their own again and again. I guess he didn't like that answer. He didn't use it. Then he asked me another question, which again has caught me unawares. He said, okay, these people need to go to AA. Why is it some of them stay sober and some of them don't? And that's absolutely correct. Anybody who's been sober any length of time knows that without, there's no explanation for it. If all the people in this front row right here, these 10 or 12 people, were all brand new today, and for the next year they went to the same meetings and had the same sponsor and did the same thing and read the same literature, in a few weeks a couple would be gone. Pretty soon a couple more would be gone. And another would be gone. By the end of the year, maybe you'd have two people left getting a first birthday cake, and nobody understands why. And so often, not even the ones you think that were going to do it. The ones that you had such hope for have been gone for 6 months. And some little puke you wished had left a long time ago has suddenly taken a turn for the better and is getting better. But why would that be? I mean, you can't blame it on genes. Can't blame it on anything. That's the interesting thing they talk about, is alcoholism caused by genes or environment. And they're just completely oblivious to the fact that in any given family, some kids are alcoholic and some aren't. Same genes, same environment. So it really is not that easy to determine. But why would that happen? And when he asked me that, I had to think about my own life and what happened to me. Because I'll tell you one thing. I am not, by any means, a masochist. I am not into pain, physically or mentally. If there are any sadists here looking for a partner, don't look at me. I'm into hedonism. Whatever comfort is available, I want to get it. We were talking at our table. Nancy at our table there was, and I were talking at a camp just almost exactly like this in the middle of Alaska 2 weeks ago. Except that they opened the meetings by reading a portion of Chapter 5 from Field and Stream magazine. Well, that I don't remember if that actually happened. But, you know, it was a light rain falling. It was kind of cool. And they had us in little log cabins. And I had a little log cabin with a fireplace. And they had newcomers assigned to bring my wood. And I thought, these people know how to put on a conference. Not like here, where I had to walk to get my own coffee. Anyway. But I am not a sage. I'm a masochist. I'm a hedonist. So I have to look at myself and wonder, what in the world would prompt me to be taken to an AA meeting, hurting badly and in deep trouble, and stay around, start to feel a little bit better, and go to AA, and then drink, and then slip year after 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 year. The worst years of my life came after I was exposed to AA and was intermittently going to AA meetings. I came as kind of a high bottom drunk my first meeting, and then I was kind of a medium bottom drunk for quite a while, up and down, and then finally kept going, and the last day I drank up till now, I woke up and two big guys, they're throwing me out of a skid row mission in Los Angeles, where I didn't know anybody, and I said, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I tried to explain to them, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write, the old LCD Elmer ads for the Borden Company, were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for one of their achievements? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. When I stood outside of that damn old mission and the light, cold rain falling, that's what made me think about that in Alaska, light, cold rain falling, and I just couldn't believe it. I just couldn't believe this could be happening to me. That can't happen to people like me. I remember thinking, this must be a dream. Any minute my wife's going to shake my arm and say, Clancy, you've kicked off all your covers. For God's sakes, get up and go to work. But it wasn't a dream. And I had a terrible feeling. I didn't know what it was. I just knew I had felt terrible. A few years ago, I listened to a guy's fourth step, and he identified this feeling. At least I believe that I could understand that feeling. It was a feeling I had, I think. That was the feeling where you stand in some place, and there is no friendly direction. There's no direction to go that at the end of that direction there's going to be somebody smiling and glad to see you. You kind of burned them off. And there's just no way to go. And it happens to all kinds of people. You think certainly on Skid Row, but a few years ago I was called upon to make a 12-step call. A friend of mine named Maurice Zales, I was now dead, said there's a guy up in Hollywood Hills, very famous man. Would I call on him? And he sure, not up and called. Went to the door, and the butler let us into the inside maid, who took us into the master bedroom, which was about as half as big as this hall, and all just lovely. Academy Award and Theater Critics Awards, every kind of award you can imagine, and all done in white and perfect and flawless. And over in the bed in the corner, this big king-size bed, this little guy cowering. They've taken his teeth out so he won't choke himself, and he's crying and crying. And over, talked to him for a long time, and he'd been in AA for a while and a number of years and left again. He didn't think he needed it, and he couldn't get sober anymore. And so we finally got him out of there, lured him out of there, and sent him to a meeting. Then to some more meetings, and pretty soon he was going to a meeting every night and doing quite well again. And after about, 5 months or so, Maurice called me one day and said, Bill is not going to go to meetings for a while. I said, why is that? He said, well, I don't know. Call him up. So I called him up. I said, Bill, what is it about to go to meetings? He said, well, my psychiatrist thinks I'm becoming too dependent on AA. He says, so I'm going to take off a few days. I said, you're making a big mistake. You're making a big mistake, I think. Come on, you just started to do good. He said, I know you mean well, Clancy, but there's a little more complexity here than you understand. And so he didn't go to the Friday night men's stag, and he didn't go to the Saturday night meeting. And we picked up this paper Sunday morning, and front page, he'd put a gun in his mouth Saturday night and killed himself. And I don't know, who's the gentleman who wrote, spoke last night. Is he here? Yeah. That man was the man who wrote Come Back, Little Sheba. William Inge. But he felt just as hopeless in that bed as I ever felt on Skid Row. But anyway, I stood there and if some old guy came up to me that morning and said, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds and you've lost your family, wife and children, never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothing. You had it with you, but apparently when they threw you in jail in Phoenix, it got lost in that jail where the guy kicked your front teeth out. And I know that happened because my gums were bleeding and my mouth was swollen. He said, you've lost your career. You're an only child, and your mother up in Wisconsin is no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you manipulate her and give her a new sad story and play on her heart, and he'd rather have her think you were dead than the way you are. He said, now you've been going to AA off and on for 10 years, and you sit and smugly and think about how smart you are in these meetings and how much more you know from your psychoanalysis than these poor people do. Why don't you, for God's sakes, go back to AA one more time and do something about it before you die? Admit you're an alcoholic. And if I would have done that, I mean, if I were sincere, I may or may not have been, but if I were sincere that morning, I had to say, pal, I can't do that. I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. My God, I'd give anything to be an alcoholic. I know there's something wrong with me. I've noticed since I was a little boy. There's something missing in me. I don't know what it is, but I never seem to feel quite enough somehow. And I just don't feel like there's something missing. I don't know what it is, but when people get close to me, they seem to be able to recognize it, and they don't seem to like me very well, so I got to kind of keep people at a distance for them to like me. I can't sustain any one-to-one relationships. I thought about that later, too, in AA, when I was working with people and coming to understand that. I finally began to understand why I never could sustain a one-to-one relationship of any kind. And it's something I never would have guessed. And it's something, if you have a deep sense of personal inadequacy see much of the time. You have not, you don't, you have to get your approval from outside, because self-approval doesn't mean much. And so I have to keep getting approval from outside me. So it boils down to this. I can see in retrospect, I hope it isn't this way now, but in retrospect for years, if you want to have a close relationship with me, I only ask one thing of you. Just treat me special all the time. Because if you treat me special, I feel average. But if you treat me average, I feel rejected. I'm going to be gone soon. And I never even realized that one of the marks of acceptance is treating you average. But when they stop treating me special, I know the bloom is off, and pretty soon I'm going to reject them before they reject me, find a way to do that. And not even be aware of it. But all my life, there's something different about me. You hear it again and again. It's hard to explain this. I don't know what it is. And I've spent thousands and thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis when I was successful to get to the root of this problem. I got into little fringe religious things with other idiots that sat on porches and discussed the meaning of the inner self and hurry home to get home before dawn so that I get back in my casket. And read books and philosophy. There's nothing hardly worse than an imitation intellectual, and I've always been an imitation. I read a lot, so I think I'm smart. And I read German philosophers that can. I'll tell you who my favorite is. Was a guy named Nietzsche. He was a very cynical, bitter guy. And I remember reading him thinking, yeah, he understands. And the bad point is you get to the end and you realize he died in the insane asylum. So then you have to go back a couple pages and see what happened. And he wasn't really insane. He just died of syphilis. He's just a good-time guy like me. That's all. But one of his most famous statements, and it's a very one I enjoy because I was raised in a very, very strict church, the Norwegian Lutheran Church. They don't have them around much because I don't know how they have young even, because it's a strict church. I don't know if it's true or not, but it sounds true that Norwegian Lutherans, even if they're married for 30 years, would never make love standing up, just in the fear that some passerby might think they were dancing. You know, it's a shock. But I was raised in this very strict church, and by the time I was 12 or 13, I knew I was going to go to hell, and it got worse after that. And I remember my drinking days telling people, you know, I would never go back to that damn church. I've broken all 10 commandments. If you break 3, you're gone. And I've broken all 10, some of them accidentally, but I broke them. And it wasn't until I was sober a while that I realized I hadn't broken all 10 commandments. I've never coveted my neighbor's manservant. Well, of course, down in Los Angeles, we always say, yet. But I lived with that knowledge all my life. I would discuss it and be cute and clever. But down deep at 2 in the morning, I was doing, I'm going to go to hell. It's a terrible feeling. And one of his works, Nietzsche, had one of his protagonists say, why are you so concerned about God? God is dead. God perhaps once existed to set the orbs of the world, but look about you. There's natural law. There's no divine law. It is anarchy wherever humans are involved. Don't be concerned. God is dead. I remember reading that thing. Oh, what? That's good news. Good news. In fact, there's a very famous theological seminary in Chicago that has his quotation on the wall. It says, God is dead. Signed Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, 1884. But underneath it says, Nietzsche's dead. Signed God, 1906. Try to stay away from places like that. But I've done a lot of things. The one thing that's ever helped me feel better, when I was 15 years old, I was a nervous, irritable, restless kid, and the war had just started, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco. My mother thought I was going to Superior, Wisconsin, and I hitchhiked to San Francisco, dumb, pimply-faced. I got one ride all the way from Minneapolis to San Francisco, a guy in the Navy. I can't believe my good luck. I wish I could find that guy sometime. And he said, you probably can't get in the Marine Corps. You look too good, but you probably get merchant marine papers. And he showed me how to do that. Now when I've got some merchant marine papers, they're just crying for merchant marine guys because all the good guys had gone in the Navy. And so I was on a ship going to the South Pacific without training or anything, just dumb kid. My pimples and on the ship with the scum of the earth. I mean, these guys were the scum of the earth. I don't mean to offend anybody. I sometimes think about this. You know, you can't pick up a paper these days without finding something. Seems like two more cases of childhood sex abuse and teachers and priests and parents and passersby and everybody. It's just terrible. I don't know if it was this way. They're just finding out about it. It's something new. I don't know. But I look back and think, I hitchhiked all the way across the country. Didn't know Sigham. Got on two ships with the scum of the earth. Scum of the earth. Filthy, rotten, dirty people. And never was sexually abused once. It makes you feel unattractive. Anyway. But among the things that happened to me on that ship, these guys drank whiskey. One of them offered me a drink of whiskey, and I didn't want to take it. But I wanted to look like a man, so I took a drink of whiskey, and I choked it up and threw it up all over them, and they laughed at me and it ridiculed me. And remember, every day after that, I'd sneak in that guy's seat bag and take a drink of whiskey. And I hated it. I'd throw it up and have to wipe it up. But I wanted so much to them to consider me a man. And we were just coming into Pearl Harbor. They're still digging up ships off the bottom. And I was taking a drink. I remember the day before my 16th birthday, and I held a drink down, and it stayed down. I thought, oh, God. Then all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. And I realized why people drink. And I didn't have any great breakthrough, because when you're in your teens is when you learn things, you know. And that ship, nobody in my family smoked. They were all religious. But they all smoked, so I smoked and puked and smoked and puked till one day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. And I learned to curse. I learned to lust effectively by listening to them. I mean, don't misunderstand me. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I'd been afraid, and I'd been apprehensive, and I'd been alone. And These fellows led me to believe it could be done with others. What a breakthrough that was. Kept me from going blind. And I didn't think much about it. And got back in another ship, and knew a little bit more then, so I wasn't quite so dumb. And when I was 17, I went in the Navy. At the end of the war, I was at a naval hospital over in outside of San Francisco. And they passed around some tests. I always been good on tests because I read a lot, so I did very well in this test. And they gave me a high school diploma because I'm still a junior in high school in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. But they gave me through the Armed Forces Institute a high school diploma, and I went back after the war and went to college, Wisconsin, after the war. And I often thought about that a couple of years ago. In fact, a couple of months ago, we had our 50th graduation reunion, class of 1950. And I was glad to see a lot of them really looked old. And I thought, boy, I really one of a kind here until I saw the group picture. And I look old, too. But I went to college, and it's kind of, most of you probably, and nobody in this room remembers that, but it was esoteric times. The only time in 1946 where millions of people all got to the service at once, and they all had the GI Bill. So all kinds of people went to college. Didn't even want to go, but something to do, get some money. So you could think of what you wanted to do, and you'd sit in freshman English class, there'd be some grizzled old ex-sergeant sitting there next to some little honey just from Plum Run High School or something. Were you in the war? Yeah, you put out. But some of them did. But I met a girl in college, and she had lovely black hair and coal black eyes, something I'd never seen much to speak of, because she was in the Lutheran church, you just see blondes and blue eyes, and you get sick of that. She looked esoteric. Then she told me she was a Catholic, and I thought, how can I tell my parents about this? But she won my heart. I got married, and I'm out in the world. I became a sports writer, newspaper sports writer, which to me is the favorite job I've ever had. Still love it. But my wife began manifesting the terrible behavior patterns of Catholic girls, and they never tell you if you're a Lutheran boy this is going to happen, but you find out. That is, if you marry a good Catholic girl, you are about to have a big family, whether you plan on one or not. And I started my career of being a national distributor of small Catholics. So I had to get better jobs, I had to get in advertising and public relations and worked up. And I remember telling my wife, I didn't know much about it, but, you know, can't we use birth control? She said, no. And I don't know what I'd have done if she had said yes. I don't know if any of you remember, but in those days, nobody mentioned birth control. Nobody mentioned condoms or anything. It was just, it would be sinful. You know, the rotten people you might meet a rotten guy in a bar, and he'd say something like, I got a rubber. And even they would be ashamed to go in and buy it. You'd have to hire some totally depraved, wet brain idiot. Maybe my grandmother was right. You marry a Catholic and this is hell. Just forever. Just eternity of listening to idiots talk about 12 steps. Jesus. And I had no idea that day or thereafter that would be my sobriety date. Didn't want it to be. I wanted to stop sometimes, and I couldn't stop. And now I have no reason to stop. No reason at all. Ridiculous. And no reason to stop. Just desperate. Just want to stay out of the rain. Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, there are authorities in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'll tell you who authorities are. They are people who come from a long ways away. For example, when you have your conventions up in Northern California or Southern California, they have speakers come in from New York and Florida and Ohio. When they have conventions in New York, they have speakers come from California. And in Texas, they come from all over, in Canada. Yeah. That's who authorities are. I'm kind of an authority in Toronto. I go there every February. They have a day all day long. In the morning, I talk about something like the traditions or the history of AA or something. And in the afternoon, they have a question and answer session. And at night, I give a talk. And I really love those. Come to love those question and answer sessions because it turns out I have a facility to weave a veritable tapestry of BS while I think of the answer. Perhaps put it in a historical context or some other. A few years ago, a woman in the back said, Clancy, I have a question. Yes. She said, every year you come up here and tell us forever about how long you slipped and how terrible it was and how long you've been sober and how wonderful it is. But what brought it about? What was the change? Could you just tell me in a sentence or two? Not one of your long answers, please. Just a sentence or two. I thought to myself, somebody ought to slap that bitch. I didn't say anything because I'm too nice a guy. But I had to say, I can't put it in a sentence or two. That's much too complex. Perhaps we can talk about it later. But she threw off my rhythm. I really hate her for that. That night I was taking a shower before I talked to this meeting, and the answer came. At least an answer came. I don't know if I liked it, said it, because it's a tawdry little answer. It's a two-bit answer. I like answers that have a little body, a little panache, a little zip, a little... If there are any newcomers here today, I hope they'd leave and... When they leave here, say things like, did you hear what Clancy said? Wet birds don't fly at night. Did you hear what Clancy said? Never mind if the horse is blind. Keep loading the wagon. These answers mean nothing, but they give the newcomer hope. I really hate to do this. I wouldn't, but I got a little bit of a sore throat. One of the purposes of sponsorship in the world is that you teach people things, and you teach them how to act, and you give them induced gratitude. I need a cup of coffee, Nancy. I've been her sponsor for 26 years. It took me 2 years just to teach her how I take my coffee. And be quick about it. But the answer I thought of that day in the shower was a dumb little answer. This was the first time I ever felt so bad I let people tell me what to do. People who I thought were stupid, who didn't know as much as I did, and who were, I wouldn't hire to mow my lawn 3 years before that. And they were telling me what to do. And I didn't do it because I wanted to do what they wanted to do, but I wanted to stay out of the rain, I guess. And not big things, not work the steps and read the book. I mean, but for example, in those days, they didn't have any styrofoam cups. Every meeting had porcelain cups. So at the end of every meeting, you have to wash dishes. And nobody wanted to do that for a while. So somebody would sit there and say, you, kid, without the tea, you want to do the dishes tonight? If I had any strength left, I'd have said, no, I don't do the dishes tonight, or tomorrow night, or any other night. Why don't you take them and lick them off yourself, you know? But I was such a, oh, don't go to any bother for me. Thank you. I think she's smart. But, you know, I just want to see the other end. So I'd say, uh-huh. Yeah, I'll do them. I think, oh, you dirty thing, you know. Hey, you without the teeth, you want to help us set up the meeting? You want to clean up? You want to mop that floor over there? Just hated it. Hated them, hated it. And little by little, I hung around. Some I stayed sober. I just resented it. Some people, a couple people tried to be nice to me, and I appreciated that. One guy took me across the street and bought me some food. And then if you stay sober a while, then you get to the next step. And the next step is, get a sponsor. Time to get a sponsor. I had a lot of sponsors over the years. People always wanted to be my sponsor, but I was a success. And I'll tell you, if you're new tonight or this morning, and people say, get a sponsor, I want to warn you about something. They don't tell you this, but no matter how nice these sponsors seem and how warm, they all want to stick their nose in your business. But I used to see this guy come in the club, and he was an actor, and I'd seen him in the movies. He was not a star, but a character actor. He always played loving roles, giving people money and helping them. And I thought, I'll get some money from this crazy fool, and I'll get my teeth fixed. I'll go back to New York. I'll get a job in an advertising agency. I'll make some money. I'll come back someday and buy this club and burn the goddamn thing down. You're like Carrie, Sister Carrie. I hope they're all in it, you know. And I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? Because, you know, they like that. Mom, I want what you have. I said, sure, kid, but I want you to do what I say. Oh, sure, Bob. I want sobriety on an all-time basis. And he became my sponsor. I've often thought of that. That guy should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played in the movies. Because they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you that. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. Just all right. I felt like Quasimodo. Why don't you ring the bell now, Bob? He wasn't mean when I look back, but he was quite firm. I remember thinking, why would I take that crap from that guy? Why would I take that crap from that guy? Because, you know, my stock and trade all of my adult life up to that time was, I don't take crap from anybody. I've had big jobs and making big dough and big advertising agencies. Somebody gives me just a little too much crap. Take your job and shove it. Get yourself another boy. I don't know how many nights in bars people might reply, you don't seem to be very much. You don't think so, son of a bitch? You try me. Come on. And I get knocked on my can a lot, but they know I'm tough. Now, why would I take crap from this guy? Why wouldn't I take crap? I've thought about that a lot. You know why? After a sober while, it suddenly began to seep in, little by little. The reason I never took crap in my adult life was because inside of me, I always secretly knew that I was a weakling, and I hate it. I hate being a weakling. That white worms crawling around us. I just hate being a weakling. If everybody implies I'm a weakling, I got to do whatever you say. It's like that Back to the Future thing where they call the kid Chicken. He has to do everything they threaten him. That's with me all my life. You threaten me, I got to do it no matter what. Because I'm not going to let anybody know I'm a weakling. And the irony in AA is this. You stay here long enough, and you do enough things, and surrender enough little by little, eventually you become strong. And when you become strong, then you can afford to be weak. But you can't afford to be weak when you're weak. The funny dichotomy. But he got me to do things, and I took crap from him. And I look back, and I think one of the reasons I took crap, because I listened to him talk, and I listened to him intently, sometimes in my rage. And I think what happened was this. I began to get a glimmer of belief that he knew how I felt. And that is the most important thing I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's why they talk about identification. Because I've been getting advice all my life from people who mean well, but they have no idea where I'm coming from, what my problems are. They just give me some good advice. Stop worrying. Do this. Do that. But this guy, I got the feeling in listening to him talk that he might know how I feel. And when you feel that, then that information becomes advice. And maybe little by little I can try some of the things that don't seem to make sense because if he knows how I'm feeling. To me, I know nothing more important. When you can believe someone knows how you feel, to me that is the conception of sobriety. That is the beginning of your sober life. And that's what makes AA so important. That's why it's so important to be a member of, to be an alcoholic, to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. Everybody can talk about recovery. But I have to believe that you know how I feel. And you can get up and talk for 2 hours about shooting up your cocaine or sniffing it. And I say, yeah, that's very important. But when a guy tells me that a drink makes him feel like something, I say, yeah, I know that feeling. That's why they formed NA and CA. So people would have places to go and identify. But little by little, I took the actions. Over a period of time, I didn't do very well. I was very slow. I fought against him. But he insisted I get little jobs. I remember, Bob, I'm just eating hand in mouth. And I'm living in my van car. What am I supposed to do, Bob? He said, get a job. I said, get a job, for Christ's sake. Look how terrible I look. He said, get a terrible job. I followed that direction to a T, I'll tell you a lot. But over a period of time, a little by little, you know, if you're kind of new, you got to remember. We talk here as if we shoot up to success. It isn't that way in sobriety. Because we have a limited time at the podium, you have to say, well, I was here, and I drank a lot, my life went to hell, then I came to this wonderful program, and now I'm wonderful. But that isn't the way it is in the real world. When you're doing it, it's, well, having a little run of bad luck, I think I got a different job. Get rid of that woman, I think, perhaps. The guy has to we'll stop having ice in my drinks or something. And one day you're down here. Then I found a new program and a new life and 12 gold steps. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh. Help! Help! I think that's the stage in AA you start to get smarter. When you're young, guys like me cry out, justice! I want justice! But as you get older and wiser, you realize you've had all the justice you can handle. No more justice! Mercy! Mercy! That's an interesting thing. The difference between justice and mercy and in AA, God's grace. We talk about grace here. You hear a while, you may come to stumble onto it. But what's the difference? You know, I'll tell you what. Kind of, you know, thumbnail. Justice is when you get what you deserve. Not many of us want that. Mercy is when you don't get what you deserve. Whew. But God's grace is when you get what you don't deserve. And most of us are familiar with that, I'm sure. I've gotten a lot of things here I don't deserve. But little by little, I stayed sober and didn't do well, had crappy jobs, finally got a little job, and I was 2 years sober. And my sponsor made me go to work every day, so I was able to hold that job and learn the great lessons of sobriety. Well, here's some great lessons, spiritual lessons of sobriety. Do what you said you would do. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Children, employees, waiters and waitresses. When you're having a bad day, watch that mouth. Because you can cut and slash and never even know that you've ruined someone else's relationship. And we all know how that goes. When you're feeling good, we're all very nice. But when we're threatened, we have a... better to keep your mouth shut than... and a lot of other things. But I was able to hold that job. And after a couple of years on that job, I was able to get some front teeth finally. I worked there 2 years, going around like this. They didn't know I didn't have front teeth. I thought it had been burned in a fire, I guess. And when I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. We all wore shiny suits and said things like, "What's coming on down, baby?" Makes you want to puke. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations with oil companies. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills for a publishing firm. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and all those children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to a post office box in Dallas, leaped out of their post office box, fled to my side. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. Then somebody got me a metronome, thank God, so now I'm into the rhythm system, which beats coitus interruptus. And they're all grown up now. My youngest kid is going to be 35 this year, that little boy. It's amazing. And they've all got three of my daughters are turning 11 this year in AA, and the rest of mine are alcoholic. The ones that are all 11 years sober. One fell in, the other two followed her. And only one of my kids has ever turned out bad. I don't know what to do about it, but I have to live with it. She's become a district attorney. I'd hope she'd be a defense attorney, but no. A few years ago, she told me she's home for Christmas. She said, "Remember, Dad, when we were little girls and you'd send us to our room?" I said, "Yes." She said, "When you come to Albuquerque, I'm going to send you to a little room." I just have no reason to go to Albuquerque. That's all. But now I live in a... And it's because of the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only therapy I've had. I used to see a psychiatrist twice a week, but I was sober about 10 years. People say, "Why would you do that?" Because I wanted this psychiatrist to go to two meetings a week or I wouldn't be a sponsor. That's why I saw him. People used to come to me and say, "I don't think A's got the answer. I need a psychiatrist." I'd say, "Sit next to Jim there at the meeting. He's a psychiatrist. Maybe he can talk to you during the coffee break." Because there seems to be no place that helps alcoholics other than this on a continuing basis. Now, all the things I've told you are accurate and true. Some of the people in this room know me well, know they're correct. But if you're new, there's one little thing I want to give you a little 5-minute talk. I've given you about a 45-minute introduction now to this 5-minute talk. Maybe the most important thing I said this morning, or I say before I sit down, I said, "My name is Clancy Immelsland, and I'm an alcoholic." Now, if you may wonder, well, when did this old fool become an alcoholic? He wasn't an alcoholic. Annette, is that you? You look younger. I didn't even recognize you. My eyes must be going bad. When Annette looks younger, your eyes are bad. She's a ventriloquist. I didn't say that. And I didn't even recognize. Good to see you, honey. Anyway, when did I become an alcoholic? I wasn't an alcoholic when I drank. I wasn't an alcoholic when I got sober. When did I become an alcoholic? As I told you, if you're kind of new, you may not quite understood. I can't be an alcoholic, really. I'd always knew this because my problem really isn't alcohol. It's much more complex and deeper than that. And imagine my surprise, hanging around AA, hanging around, getting little jobs, going to meetings I thought were stupid, taking crap from people I didn't like, getting a sponsor finally, doing these things, and somehow surviving as a non-alcoholic long enough to discover that what AA says, if my problem is alcohol, I'm not an alcoholic. Isn't that startling? The reason I thought it was not an alcohol, I was not an alcoholic, AA says is correct. Of course, you may think, of course the problem is alcohol. What's this old guy talking about? You think it's alcohol? I can disprove that in 5 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Hospitals, jails, they turn out sober people with varying amounts of information what may be wrong with them. But I'll guarantee you if they be of my type, unless something dramatic happens after that, sooner or later they will always drink again. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what is it? Is it something they're not telling us? Is it this kind of like Scientology? Do we have to tie their money perhaps and get some videos or whatever? No? No? Everyone in this room, the newest person knows what's wrong with them, but you have no idea, you cannot define it really. The problem here sounds like alcohol and confuses a lot of people. The problem is something called alcoholism. You say, well, that's the same thing for God's sakes. Alcohol, alcoholism, the same thing? Not the same thing. I'll guarantee you, it is tremendously different. The day must come when your sanity and your life depends on remembering the difference. So what's the difference? Well, I could talk about that for 2 hours, I guess, if we had the time. But I can put it in one sentence, too. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism, which unfortunately for you and me looks almost exactly the same to the naked eye. This mind-consuming, perception-distorting, bodily-eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism. You'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. But even that doesn't make you an alcoholic. One more thing must be present. You must be one of the 6 or 7 or 8% of people, and nobody knows why, to this day, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. So, of course, they immediately ask the question, what's the unnatural reaction? I can tell. And you go to meetings, you hear people talk about the unnatural reaction. Some, I stayed drunk for 20 years. Somebody else said, I was in 8 jails and nut houses, and you think, that's what it does. Nah, not at all. Just the opposite. I almost died before I realized this. It isn't what alcohol does to you at all. Just the opposite. It has to do something special for you that it doesn't do for most people. It must almost instantly alter my perception of reality. It must almost instantly change my relationship to the world. It must almost instantly fill holes in me that nothing else does. Because unless it does that for me, it will never do anything significant to me. Because as soon as it starts doing something to me, I'll stop doing it. But when I have to depend on it to survive the bad feelings, I will drink again. And the irony, when you get near the end, and some of you have been there, you wind up in a situation you don't realize you're in it, but it's, you can't explain it to anybody. I'm drinking to forget my drinking. You don't really do that. Drinking causes problems. I drink to forget those problems, which causes more problems, cause me to drink, on and on. That phenomenon is called alcoholism. And everyone secretly thinks there's got to be a way to beat it. And I am not an alcoholic, I guess. Today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, some of us were at a convention a couple weeks ago, 3 or 4 weeks ago, some 50,000 sober alcoholics, the largest group of sober alcoholics in the history of mankind. And there's conventions all over, up and down, all the states, and all the countries around the world. In America, this heart of AA, it is estimated in America that about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. what, 95%. A number of people in this room will die drunk. Not because AA doesn't work, but because our heads will tell us we don't need it. We don't have to be here. It isn't the way it seems. That happened to my sponsor who taught me that. And 15 years later, he drank and died because he stopped doing the things. That's why it's important to realize that getting sober and being slick won't help you. Because what I got to do here is something much more complex than stop drinking. If drinking were the problem, detox would be the answer, as I said. But the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is not to get you sober. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous is, after sobriety, take a series of actions that don't even seem to make sense in the long run, but little by little do what? They little by little change my perception of reality. I think I can safely say the purpose of AA, as far as I know, is to very, very slowly do what alcohol did fast. To change my ability to live in the world. To little by little live with some degree of dignity. And it's that way all over. I've been sober a long time. I was thinking last night, I was the only one in the room over 40 years sober. I was the only one in the room over 30 years sober. I feel like an old redwood sometimes. Except when you're sober a long time, people bring you coffee. But I've had the chance over the, because I've stayed active all these years, I've had the chance over the last few years to do some things that most of you haven't had a chance to do yet. In the last 4 or 5 years, I've been asked to come and speak in exotic places like Cape Town and Johannesburg and Berlin and Paris and London and Belfast and Dublin and Oslo. I was in Oslo last summer. They took me up to the where my grandfather and his brothers came from in the 1880s. It has suddenly, for the first time, struck me what's wrong with having, among other things, a Norwegian head. Because it suddenly struck me, these guys left Norway in the 1880s to get out of that damn climate, come to America. Then they all settled in Wisconsin and Minnesota and spent the next 40 years saying, Jesus is cold here too. Yeah, Chris. That's the kind of head I face every morning when I get up. Ooh. But you know, I've been a lot of places, all over Canada. A couple months ago, I was in Australia, New Zealand, and Costa Rica, and Mexico. You'd think it'd really be exotic in all these places, but it isn't. Except for the accents, you hear the same things you hear right here in your meetings, here, Mariposa or Fresno or wherever it might be. There are some people who are having a great deal of difficulty believing they should be here, and there are some people who have been here a while trying to show them it'll work, and there are some people who refuse to do it, and they joke and ridicule the people who are doing it. It almost boils down to three different little camps in almost every meeting, however large it is. A group of people who have come here and whatever the reason have taken the actions, sometimes motivated by pain, and they are now have a different perception of reality. A group of people who cannot or will not take these actions and ridicule and talk down and criticize those that do. And in the middle there are the new people, and both of these groups fight for their soul. And it's amazing almost we keep as many as we do, because the arguments against AA are really better than the arguments for it. The arguments for it are just, well, it works. It's worked for all sorts of people. And that's why we do these things. And that's why we get together to share our experience, strength, and hope. I've been getting a lot of questions lately about antidepressants. I have no opinion on antidepressants. Except my opinion is Alcoholics Anonymous is the best antidepressant I ever heard of. And I've been taking it steadily for 42 years and I haven't needed anything else. I know this, that I've not become a wonderful man. Some people today become wonderful. You just feel like saying, oh. But eventually God gives them a beer and they come back. No matter how long you stay, you'll never rise above human being. But the purpose of A is the same. The last thing I want to say is that the funny twist on the end of my life, I guess. When I was 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills and doing quite well. And in some hideous fit of judgment, I left a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 26 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1974, or 1958. And so every I go to Skid Row. And people say to me, why would you give up your advertising career that just started to take off and go back to run that damn mission? And I can never think of a good answer for that. I think of, well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it must be spiritual. And I don't... And tomorrow morning, I'll get in my car out by the ocean where I live, Comfort. I'll go down that jam-packed Santa Monica freeway. And my car still wants to get off at Beverly Hills and go down to the middle of Skid Row and look at my desk and see who died over the weekend, who stabbed who smashed her into the sidewalk. I have a position that most of you don't have, I'm sure. I get out of my car, and I usually have to step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office on the sidewalk. And I go home and die. Sometimes the same ones, sometimes different ones. And I go there, and we have a staff of about 150 men, all of them off the street, and we do quite a bit. And I go home and die. The funny thing is this, that when I go home and die, I always seem to feel like I've done a little bit more than I ever did going down those elevators in Beverly Hills, popping my fingers and being hip and slick and cool. And I feel as though there's some reason for my existence somehow. Now, don't misunderstand me if you're kind of new. Even if you work the steps, painfully and laboriously as you might, and you have a sponsor and go to meetings and take the actions, try to help others, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. There's only so many to go around. I got mine. And but I can guarantee you that you find yourself, perhaps after 15 years in doing these things, walking with some degree of dignity. Maybe as I have done, under great help from the people when I was new, little by little come to overcome my disbelief and hatred of God, and over a period of time come to believe maybe God didn't hate me, and then finally come to believe that He loves me as much as anybody else, no more, no less. I just got to get my receiver going right so somebody gets in. They might live with some degree of peace, some degree of self-worth, and when that day comes, it's worth all it took. Because Alcoholics Anonymous, I've said a lot of things about it, and I've talked about it a lot, but there's a guy in our group who's a Hispanic guy, and he doesn't speak English very well. He's dead now, but I think what he said his name was Ramon Pena. He'd get up and he'd say, "I don't have much to say, but I just want to say this. AA works, and it works good." And I want to tell you that. AA works, and it works good. Thank you.